Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I am recording on Sunday, yesterday. I was in Bloomington, Indiana, from Wednesday night through Sunday morning. And I go there once a year, once every year and a half I go. I've been there a lot over the last decade. And I got to be honest, every time I'm going, I go to play the Comedy Attic up there. And I always get a little like, oh man, it's going to get weird. Something's going to be weird. It's always weird. It's subtle. It's a disarming town because it's a college town and it feels like that. But there's just a little weirdness on the periphery there. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it didn't get weird this time, though. It didn't get weird with the audience. It didn't get weird with the people that approached me. I didn't have any weird encounters. But maybe that's a testament to my weird magnet being turned off or down quite a bit. I don't know, man. I'm definitely a little less needy. Is that an announcement? Oh, by the way, 2 days ago on the first was the 9th anniversary of this show. We've been at this for 9 years and 2 days now. Brendan McDonald and myself and all our guests are very grateful that you've listened all these years. Many of you have, but it's sort of a big deal. I didn't really know it was happening until someone mentioned it on Twitter, but it is 9 years. That's fucking unbelievable. So much has happened. So much has happened in the 9 years. And those of you who've been on board for most of it know exactly what those things are. And thank you for going through all that with me. I appreciate it. Back to Bloomington. So I got to be honest, man. I love the place. I like going there. I was very relaxed. And I'm not always relaxed on the road. I am always somewhat happy to be away. Because I think I've talked about it before, when you're out there in a strange city or unfamiliar terrain and it's just you in a room that you're not responsible for cleaning, and you know, everything about your day-to-day life that you live normally is far away, and you're just in this rented box. Sometimes when you got some space, it's nice to take advantage of it. Like, I can sit on my porch, I can wander around these streets, but there's always the responsibility of my life hanging over me. And I got to Bloomington, and you know, within a few hours, I was just sort of like, oh, good. And I brought the newest copy of The Baffler, which is a magazine that I get. I don't know if it's, I think it's every 2 months, and it's very dense usually. It's got, you know, it's fun, it's got art, it's got poetry, but it's got some almost academic, but very cutting cultural criticism in there, usually themed through an issue. And I usually read one or two things in there, and my brain just explodes. It's not that it's incapable of taking it, but this time I was just processing it. I was rolling up the copy of it and walking around with it. I had my notebook going. I'm stopping in the middle of a supermarket parking lot to write down thoughts. I'm adding some wood to the fire of my brain and kind of formulating new ideas, new bits, just pushing my brain out there as I wandered in the sort of humidity of Indiana, which is great for me because, you know, I'm sober a long time. But if you get the right humidity and you're at the right amount of needing sleep, you get a little buzz on. You move a little slower. It's kind of like it's a little thick. It's like moving through a sort of almost set pudding of atmosphere. And it was great. I had an advanced copy of my buddy Sam Lipsight's book, which is fucking hilarious. It's called Hark. It's going to be out in a few months. I got to get him in here. And it was just amazing to sort of open up my brain again and to sort of be relieved of the cats and house and day-to-day shopping. I was in the box, then I walk out of the box and I wander around and just writing things down, getting the brain active. And then I'd go to this amazing club, the Comedy Attic. And it's amazing because it's off the grid, man, in a lot of ways. You got to fly into Indianapolis and you got to drive to Bloomington, but there's a nice sort of cross section of you know grown-up weirdos there that that come see me. I sold out all five shows. It's a little place. It only seats like 170, but that is the type of club where you can get into that one mind feeling with an audience. And you know, and four out of the five shows were kind of transcendent. And one of them was just work a bit. It was still good, but it was like there wasn't the freedom there. But because I'm wandering around all day, I'm smoking cigars, I'm hot, I'm writing things down, I'm pushing my brain out there, I'm getting into the zone where I don't give a fuck and I can take risks and just follow and process my own stream of consciousness up there. It's one thing, you know, showing up at a theater with a polished act. It's another thing being in the crucible, in the sort of, you know, tide pool of your brain, just evolving shit out of it. And it was just, it's always great. It's always a great five shows. Jared runs a good room up there, and I'm grateful for it. I think I'm smoking too many cigars, though. That I can tell you right now. Man, you get me going on shit. Hey, you guys have been through this with me before. If you've been here 9 years, you've been through all of it. You've been through all of it with me. Also, another interesting thing, some guy showed up at the show. It was his 11th time seeing me. Man, 11th time. People came from all over the place, man. It was really humbling and kind of powerful, man. People came from Detroit, from St. Louis, from Cincinnati. They came up from Kentucky. Some people flew in from San Diego, from Philadelphia. I mean, to this little club in Bloomington, Indiana. They came from all over. And it's like when I see them tweet about it or whatever, it's a lot of pressure. I'm like, oh, my God, they drove 5 hours. I better deliver the fucking goods. Not that I wouldn't want to do that anyways, but it does add extra pressure. But I think everybody had a good time. And also in that club, there's no real point. There's only a little fucking green room. So I'm always outside. I'm outside meeting, greeting, because it's a small enough room to do that. So you got the first show getting pictures with me while the second show is waiting to go in. I did a little pre-show, you know, outside for the line, you know, working all angles. Not intentionally. It's just there was nowhere else to go. But 11 times seeing me. That's wild. Man, it's almost like I'm like a fish show. I'm surprised the guy's not following me around the country. Well, I don't work that much. I don't do that many dates. I think that's another reason why. And I didn't mean to compare myself to fish. It was just a joke about a jam band. You know, like maybe I'm not the jam band of comedy. That is not me. I don't tour enough, which is why people came from so far away. I'm not the kind of, you know, 100 dates a year kind of guy. I'm like, let me put together, take some my time, put this stuff together, maybe do 20, 30 dates a year and run through it. But yeah, I don't have a tour plan, but I'm sure I will next year after GLOW, get some dates on the books. And that's what's happening. Oh, every time I'm in Bloomington, I go to Landlocked Records, picked up some wax, some vinyl, a few slabs. I don't think that's what they're called. They don't call them slabs. Landlocked Records has some great stacks, man. They got the racks, but beneath the racks, there's just a bunch of records on the floor. You know, they're alphabetized, but they're not the top shelf records, but there's a lot of good shit in there. What'd I pick up? I got an old Bee Gees record from the late 60s called Idea. I picked up a Tommy James record because I think it's called Me, My Bed, and My Red Guitar. I don't know much about it, but it looked like something I might want. I actually got the Rosington Collins Band record. That's the what was left of Lynyrd Skynyrd after the crash. I've never let Skynyrd go. I'll forgive them, Sweet Home Alabama, even though I like that song. And there's no reason. It's not a guilty pleasure. They're a great fucking band. You know what? I love Lynyrd Skynyrd all the way through, the whole fucking catalog. What else did I get? I got a Miles Davis album I didn't have, and I got a Coltrane record that just got released of a live performance, a double record. I don't know the name of it. Looking forward to listening to that. But for some reason, I really want to go listen to that fucking Bee Gees record. I'm trying to get into old Bee Gees. There's a couple songs I like, but anyways, I'm rambling. Landlocked Records, always a stop for me in Bloomington. And yeah, it was a good time. Did I mention who's on the show today? I did not. I did not mention. Today, Dan Schlissel joins me. Dan Schlissel is the proprietor, producer, and overseer and owner of Stand Up Records. Stand Up Records is a comedy album label. He's done a lot of different people. Schlissel's done everybody from me to Stanhope to Maria to everybody. He recorded two of my records. He reissued my first record. And the funny thing about Dan is, the first album I did with him was, I think Tickets Still Available. And that was in Seattle. And it was funny because, you know, I didn't have a draw. So we did four shows, you know, for like anywhere from 60 to 150 people, maybe. And he spent about, you know, 6 months to a year mixing that thing. I think I'm exaggerating, but not by much. But the amazing thing was is that when I was going through my divorce and my life was falling apart and I needed to be on stage to process it, I would always go to this shitty little club in Seattle called Giggles. The guy who ran the place, Terry, you know, he used to, you know, sell the tickets, make the drinks, do 5 minutes to open the show and wait on tables. And he was a very bizarre guy. He'd always, you know, figure out a way to short you $100. But it was a dirty little club, and I recorded two fucking albums there. Thank you, Terry. I don't mean to shit on your club. It's gone now, but you know who you are. But on that second one, I booked the date on a few weeks' notice because I was losing my mind in a terrible state of grief and anger. And I called Schlissel up, and I said, is there any way you can get to Seattle with the equipment? And let's fucking get this stuff down. I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, I'm on fire. And he did it, and that was my album. He came out on pretty short notice, and that was Final Engagement, which was definitely the separation/divorce album. It's pretty grim, pretty dark, pretty focused, the tone is not necessarily pleasant, but it's one of my favorite records that I've done, and Dan did that. And so I thought, he was in town. I thought it was a unique opportunity to talk to somebody who is on that side of the business, a guy who loves comedy, who is very attentive to the process of recording comedy. And everybody knows him. We all know him, and most of us have done a record with him. So if you want more information about him, you can go to, or about stand-up records in general, you can just go to standuprecords.com, see the catalog. But this is me talking to Dan Schlitt.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So. So Schlissel, I have not seen you in a while, and you show up. You look like you're in bad shape.
Well, you know, life brings us interesting things as we move forward through it.
Yeah, you hobbled up like an old Jew.
I'm turning into an old Jew.
How old are you?
47.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can't remember when we met. I can't remember how long ago that was, but what, now do you want to talk about what's going on with you?
Yeah, it's okay. I can talk about pretty much anything. It's a real harrowing tale though.
Oh yeah?
I found myself getting weaker and weaker for a period of a few years.
Yeah.
No idea why.
Right.
All of a sudden, I started sweating profusely as well. Something I can't control.
Right. You never had that before?
No. I mean, I always had overweight guy sweat.
Yeah.
But I never had just standing for 2 minutes and then, like, I ran a marathon sweat.
Right. Oh, geez. Yeah.
Yeah. So my arms went numb while I was on a recording trip in New Orleans.
Both of them?
Both of them, from the elbows down to the fingertips. Hmm. Like, they were on fire, but I couldn't feel anything besides
right.
that.
Yeah.
And I came home from New Orleans, scheduled an appointment with a doctor.
Yeah.
I had had lower back surgery earlier that year.
Yeah.
My family doctor sent me to a neurologist. Neurologist sent me for MRIs. I took a copy of the MRIs to show my spinal surgeon.
Yeah.
And my wife and I went in, and he stared at that MRI. He looked at us, didn't say anything, then stared back at the MRI again. Yeah. Right? That's the international medical symbol for you're screwed.
Right. The no saying glance.
Yeah. Like looking at you and not knowing what to say.
Yeah. How do we talk about this? Yeah.
So then he tells me that my body's turning my ligament into bone in my neck.
Uh-huh.
And it's pressing against my nervous system.
Yeah.
And it's going to cause paralysis probably if I don't have surgery.
Right.
And I said, okay. He goes, I'm the wrong doctor. I need you to speak to a colleague. I said, okay. He goes, that'll be tomorrow. Go home. Don't do anything.
Yeah.
Here's a neck brace.
Yeah.
Don't drive. Don't go up and down stairs. Don't get in the shower.
Really?
Sit.
Huh. Wow. Urgency.
Urgency. Urgency.
Yeah.
Urgency.
Yeah, yeah.
That night, the neurologist called, same verdict.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
The next day, the neurosurgeon does the same thing with the MRI.
Yeah.
It turns out, had to have surgery. It took a month. So I was in a neck brace for a month and my muscles in my neck were atrophying the whole time. They took me in for surgery and they cut open the back of my neck and fused C2 through C6.
Yeah.
So I have 10 titanium screws and 2 rods in my neck now.
Is that going to stop the progress of the...
It should arrest the development of the disease any further.
Yeah.
But in that time, my neck atrophied, my muscles was all cut open to have the surgery, and then I was on a massive amount of painkillers.
Right.
4 days after the surgery, the hospital left me in an improper position. I choked to death on my neck brace.
You choked to death?
To death.
In
the hospital.
Uh-huh.
The only reason I'm here now is because my wife was there.
Uh-huh.
I opened my eyes and looked at her and tried to say, help me over and over again, and couldn't push air.
Uh-huh.
And she ran and got the nurse. And if she hadn't been there, I wouldn't be here.
So you didn't actually die?
No, the nurse said 1 to 3 minutes dead.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You were dead 1 to 3 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ. So the thing made the beep.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you sue the hospital?
I tried to talk to a lawyer and all that, but there isn't enough proof to make
that you were
case.
In the wrong position?
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, sometimes... suing's bad karma anyways.
I didn't really want to do it anyhow, but one of my lawyer friends said you really ought to just see how far you can take this in case.
Yeah, because he died for 3 minutes.
And I picked up, you know, a bunch of other stuff because of it.
What do you mean?
After the surgery, I had an infection in the wound. They had to reopen it up to clean it out.
Yeah, that happens a lot here in hospitals.
It was brutal.
Like, was it that bad infection?
It was actually E. coli.
Right, but it wasn't the...
It wasn't MRSA.
Oh, MRSA. Yeah, that's the one. That's bad, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they say E. coli in a wound is bad. It doesn't affect your digestive system, but it's just hard to kill.
Yeah, but you bounce back?
Yeah, I mean, 2.5 years later, I feel great.
Yeah?
as great as I can. I look like an old Jew now, but...
What's with the cane?
Because I have these neck and back problems, it's hard to support the weight of my head because my neck is not a normal straight up and down neck. I lean forward.
Yeah.
So every time you... have a little bit of forward lean to your head, it adds gravity and weight to your head.
Right.
And it just continues that. So the cane is to help support it.
Right.
But part of the reason I have the cane now is I went to a 2-day concert in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
And I overdid it.
See what happens? We're getting old either way.
Yeah.
And you want to go go take in some punk rock.
Yeah. But I took it in from the soundboard, not in the crowd, though.
You got connections?
Well, no, I just know where to stand so that I'm far away from the people that are running into each other.
Oh, so you do that on purpose?
Oh, yeah. Now I do, yeah.
Right.
I can't take too many shots to my back or head.
So I'm trying to remember, I was looking at the roster of stand-up records, and, I don't know how early on I was with, I think the first one you recorded for me, was Tickets Still Available?
Yeah, that's release number 21.
Okay, so I was the 21st.
Yeah, and if you include the reissue of Not Sold Out, that was number 17.
Really? You reissued that before we did Tickets Still Available?
It was being reissued as we were recording.
Oh, okay.
Because if you remember, the poster that we did for the recording of Tickets Still Available was the cover of Not Sold Out.
Right, that became the new cover. That's right. Yeah, that guy. Who did that poster?
Jeff Kleinsmith.
Yeah,
works over at Sub Pop.
Yeah, Jeff Kleinsmith. I have that poster somewhere. It's over there against the wall. I'll get it back up. It was up in the old garage.
No, I saw the photo.
Yeah, yeah, right. Oh, the photo I posted on Instagram?
Yeah, yeah.
That was, I forgot, that's that photo. So then we did that one at Giggles, and we did, years later, we did Final Engagement, which I thought might be my last comedy record, at Giggles.
Right, again. We went twice, which surprised the heck out of me.
The worst comedy club in the world.
Absolutely.
But as a room, it was a good room.
It was a good room, and you got a good room. You know how to play a room anyway.
Yeah.
You always did.
Yeah, but it was a little weird room, and
the thing you said to me when you said, I want to do Final Engagement there, and I go, really? He goes, you said, the room makes me so crazy, I feel like anything can happen.
Yeah, and we did it on like a week, not much notice. I was just sort of like, I'm going through this thing, I'm separate, things are fucked up in my life, and I think we need to get it down. I knew it was a short notice, like a few weeks, right?
It was under a month, if I remember right.
Right, for you, I just booked out Giggles and had you drive over.
It was worth it, though. Honestly, and this is not the brown nose you, it might be the best record that I've put out on stand-up.
Oh, thank you
very much. It's a tremendous record, and I'm still very proud of that one in particular.
Well, you did a great job with it, and it was definitely a tonally intense record.
Yeah, but I mean, see, the craziness that you bring, like that whole thing whenever you leave the house, you picture other people having sex with your wife. Oh, yeah. Like the level of paranoia that you got into.
Yeah.
I related to that so readily that it was just, it made everything else just beautiful for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm proud of that record. I like the whole trilogy, really. But let's go back, because I met you. I'm trying to remember how I first met you. Why did we come in touch with each other? Why did it happen? Do you remember?
I totally remember. I ordered Not Sold Out from your website.
Okay.
Got it. And was a little... I was a little disappointed that it came in like a cardboard sleeve, and that I knew that you had done it yourself because you had used artwork that was not, you had modified it, but it was still photos from the movie Freaks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew you couldn't release that on a wider scale.
I kind of knew that too.
Okay, good.
I remember ordering all those and getting them in envelopes. I was like, fuck it, I'll just put them in envelopes with pictures on them and you know, I'm going to sell them. It was just really specifically supposed to be website and road merch.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I wasn't really thinking of a big release. I didn't think I had the juice for that. And I just went the cheapest way possible at the time because it was all self-produced.
Right.
And the guy that recorded it, Jason Spiro, was just this weird kind of massive comedy fan who used to hang around the alt comedy scene in New York and take pictures. And he designed websites and, you know, he had a dat deck.
Oh, nice.
So that was just the thing. I just had him, again, spontaneously record that thing for an audience of like 30 at Stand Up New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea that was, that small of an audience. It makes sense, though, because I just recorded at Stand Up New York for the first time, you know, produced something there.
Yeah.
And I was surprised at the small turnouts and the small size of the club.
Yeah, always. Well, I mean, they used to have bigger ones, but it was an off night, and that was recorded not long after 9/11. It was still weird there. But it's okay, so you ordered that, and you're like, what, this guy needs a bigger release?
I thought so. I mean, to me, look, I grew up in the Midwest involuntarily.
Yeah.
And Comedy Central, you know, back when they showed a lot of stand-up.
Right.
That was a lifeline to me to what I called civilization, which means not the middle of Nebraska.
Right. Oh, yeah, right.
So you, whether you like it or not, to me, you were a legend already in my head.
Right.
So,
because you related to me.
I related to you.
So you saw me on those clips, like from Caroline's.
On all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I get this CD and I'm like, this guy deserves more than this. He's so good. Why would he do this?
Yeah, well, why would he do this? Because you're like one of nine people that thought I was good, and I appreciate it.
But thank God.
Yeah,
right. I mean, it really gave me a chance to work with you.
Yeah. So and you reached out to me?
As soon as I got the CD, I wrote to you on the website and said, hey, you know, what's going on with this? Could there be a way to do it better? You know, this is what I do, sort of.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of like, right. But, and I remember, like, I don't remember. Did I respond pretty quickly?
Or? Yeah. I was amazed to get a response at all. Because half the time you write to a website and it just goes into the ether, you know?
No, sometimes. But, I mean, it depends. Again, like, I wrote Checky Green's website and I heard back from someone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, claiming not to be him. But it was clearly somebody who was either sitting next to him or very close to him. All right. So how does it start for you? Because we did do those records. And I remember... My big thing for both records is like how long it took, and I used to bother you because you're very meticulous. But it turns out it's fine, even though I busted your balls about it.
Not only do you are such a yeller. Oh, my God.
Really?
Then?
What did I do?
Every phone call was like, I could hold it away from my head.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You came in hot on all those, justifiably. But you were hot on a lot of those conversations.
About like how long it was taking?
Yeah. But at the same time, you weren't watching John and I file jockey everything and go through every step of the processing to make the sound better
and
better.
Yeah, my experience was, you know, like that guy just came to the club with a thing and I got a thing.
Right.
You know, so like, but like over time I realized, you know, what you guys are doing because you're breaking down four shows.
At least, I think four, maybe five.
For tickets?
Yeah. I have to look at the dates again because that part I don't remember so well.
But so you grew up in Nebraska?
We moved to Nebraska 3 days before I started in the seventh grade from the Poconos.
Oh, so you grew up, were they Orthodox?
No, my folks are conservative. My folks are Israeli immigrants. My mom is Israeli. My dad was born in Poland.
How, really?
Yeah.
So how'd they end up in the Poconos?
My dad, he was in a commando unit, basically.
In the Israeli army.
In the Israeli army. And, yeah. You know,
and originally from Poland.
Born in Poland, yeah.
So he went to Israel as part of the sort of, what do you call it, the diaspora?
No.
What do you call it? Was he running from anything?
Yeah. At 2 years old, the war broke out in Poland, and his dad knew what was coming, destroyed his business, and they fled to the Russian half
from
of
Hitler.
Poland.
No shit.
And then the Russians said, you ran, you're traitors, Siberia.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So that he was in Siberia? When
from age 2 to 7.
With his family?
With his family. And he lost his father there because his father decided not... if I remember the story right, my grandfather did not work once on Yom Kippur, and the Russians said, you don't work, you don't eat. Anyone who gives you food also won't eat. And they starved him to death.
That's the story.
That is the story.
It's heavy, man.
And my dad remembers... My dad felt personally responsible for the death of his father.
Yeah.
Because... he wouldn't give him his food.
Because he couldn't. So that's kind of a mind fuck.
It was a weird thing for me to grow up with that filter.
Yeah.
You know.
So, but your grandmother survived?
My grandmother and my dad's four sisters survived. One of his sisters had cross eyes because one of the Russians hit her in the head with the butt of a rifle for disobeying something.
No shit.
Yeah.
So how'd they get out of Russia to go to Israel?
After the war, slowly but surely, they parted out and got smuggled out. Like, the kids got smuggled out first.
Uh-huh.
And then they got smuggled by train all the way to Germany, and the Allied soldiers didn't know what to do with them, so they put them in a displaced persons camp, and all the displaced persons camps were former concentration camps.
Wow.
And my dad has vivid memories of meeting Eisenhower and Mickey Marshall.
Really?
They came to inspect the place and then took the kids.
Which camp was it?
I don't know the name of the camp. I could find out.
It was in Poland?
This was in Germany.
In Germany. Okay.
And
after the liberation.
After the liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And the generals threw out a bunch of German refugees from a fancy hotel and put the kids up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So my dad always loved Americans after that.
Now, I wonder if that's going to happen with these kids today.
Oh, God.
It's fucking horrendous.
It is so terrible right now.
So, all right, so they make it to Israel.
Yeah.
Your dad grows up there,
mm-hmm.
does his service time, right?
Yep.
And he loves Israel?
He loved Israel a lot. He wanted to go back in his older age, but it just didn't work out.
And what about your mom? She was Israeli as well?
My mom was born in Palestine.
Uh-huh. Before Israel.
Before Israel.
So they were older people, huh?
Yeah, my mom's almost 80 now. My dad has been gone for 24 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What happened?
Cancer, weird place.
Jeez.
Yeah.
So what did you say on the porch that the thing you got in your neck is genetic too?
It's a genetic thing, but it mainly affects a small population of Asian men.
Have you done the 23andMe thing?
I have not.
I wonder.
My dad's family's from Poland. My mom's family's from the Ukraine and from Baghdad.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So possibly.
But she's a Jew.
Yeah, the Iraqi Jews were there from the time of the destruction of the first temple.
Wow.
Yeah.
Some old Jews.
Old Jews.
Old school Jews.
Old school.
So what made them decide to come here?
My dad kept on getting called up into the Israeli Army Reserves, which can happen until you're 55.
Wow, yeah.
And because he was in special units, they kept calling him back, and it bankrupted his textile mill that he had built with my mom.
So the requirement, his skill set,
the
military,
mm-hmm.
fucked him
hard.
Yeah.
So he got out, and he was trying to get out at a lower rank than he was.
Yeah.
He finally got out, got papers, came to America because he had a sister living in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Started trying to work to bring over the family, and then because he was an eligible alien, almost got sent to Vietnam.
Jeez.
Yeah.
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 That would have been.
He said that they pulled him up to the draft board, and it was literally old men deciding young men's fate.
And how old was he?
In 1967, he was 30.
Wow. So how did he not go?
They finally figured out he had a wife and kid in another country, and if he died in battle, the government was going to have to pay for them for the rest of their lives.
Oh, so it was a financial thing?
It was a financial decision on the government's
part. And that was early on in that war, too, really.
Yeah, 67, though. They were trying to send him to the 101st Airborne Division, which got hammered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Yeah, it was a fucking meat grinder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he got out of that, and he starts a business?
He started working for other people.
Yeah.
His first job application, they gave him a resume, and he barely understood English.
Yeah.
Like, he learned the alphabet from my mom the day before he got on the plane.
He spoke Hebrew and Polish?
He spoke Hebrew, Polish, Yiddish, a little bit of Arabic, and Russian.
Right. So how did he get your mom over here?
He put in the resume. They gave him the application. He gave it back and said, try me for a week, and if you don't like me, don't hire me.
For what?
Textiles.
Yeah. What does that mean? Weaving?
At the time, weaving and mechanical work.
Okay.
So he did that for about 6 to 8 months, I think.
Uh-huh.
And then my mom and brother came over.
Because he had money saved up?
Enough money for a place and to make sure that they were set.
And that was in the Poconos?
No, that was in Massachusetts. My dad, Chatham Mills and all those places.
Oh,
well,
yeah, right.
Massachusetts had a big textile history.
Sure, yeah.
But then that was the time that it was starting to leave Massachusetts.
Right.
So from there, we went to New Jersey. From New Jersey, we went to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And then from Pennsylvania, it was to Midwest.
All textile work?
All textiles.
Never opened his own business again?
Nope.
So Nebraska was a textile job.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Omaha?
No. 3.5 hours west of Omaha in a town called Holdridge is where he worked. When my mom saw the town the first time, she burst into tears. Said, I can't live in a place this small. So my dad commuted almost 40 miles a day to live in a town that was 30,000 people.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And was it, did you like it there?
No, I hated it.
Why?
I was the only Jewish kid. I got beat up 3 to 5 times a week.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just rampant, sort of brutal anti-Semitism?
All of this stuff that's coming to light under President Trump is no surprise to me.
Yeah.
Because I lived under the people who are supporting him the most that are my age.
Yeah.
I know what they were like 30 years ago.
Right.
Because they were kicking my ass then.
Yeah.
That same bigotry is still in them.
Of course.
And now they're just feeling themselves.
Yeah, right. They're waking up.
Yeah, and it's not everyone in the Midwest. There's plenty of enlightened people.
Right.
But there are plenty of idiots.
Yeah.
That are just ignorant and hateful. And
yeah. And like, did you ever get badly hurt?
I got hit with pipe. I got hit with chains.
Really?
Yeah. My dad finally said, I didn't serve in the military in Israel and survive the Holocaust for you to be in a gigantic pussy.
Yeah.
He said the next time someone he said the next time someone raises a hand to you, you either beat the shit out of them or don't come home. And then he enrolled me in karate classes.
Yeah.
And that's 100%.
Did you beat the shit out of anybody?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, over time. I learned karate enough.
Yeah.
But if it got closer than fists and into wrestling, I would lose. So then I went out for wrestling for 2 years.
So, and then you leveraged your weight on them.
Well, then I grew. I grew from 5'8 to 6'4.
Yeah.
In between my sophomore and junior year.
Did they stop fucking with you?
Once I hurt a couple people, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's crazy. And how many siblings do you have?
One.
What, a sister?
Brother. Same age as you.
Oh, really? A little older.
Yeah, 7 years.
7 years older than you.
Yeah.
Where was he?
We lived in Pennsylvania. He went to college in Pennsylvania. We moved to Nebraska. There was no reason for him to move. He was in college.
Oh, and is he still around?
He is.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
You get along with him?
We're not close at all. We haven't spoken in years.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I think that we embarrass him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think we're a little too old-worldy, ethnic-y for him.
No kidding.
Yeah.
But he's a Schlissel.
He's a Schlissel, but he distances himself. He cut off the whole family, not just my mom and me, uncles, aunts, cousins.
For no reason?
No, not that I know of. I mean, I'm sure he has a reason.
Is he married with kids and everything?
He's married with a stepdaughter.
Huh. Yeah. It doesn't bother you?
It bothers the hell out of me, but, you know, I also don't, if that's his wish, it's fine.
You don't reach out?
Tried to under duress from a relative.
Yeah.
And
nothing.
It's not going to ever happen again. I'm not.
Wow. And it's why that age difference is sort of like wide enough to where you probably didn't know him that well.
Oh, no. I wanted to be him. I looked up to him. I loved him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was he,
I'm an artsy, out of shape, you know, weirdo. And he's like more of a mainstream manly man and scuba dives and does work with his hands. And just like. Yeah. A man's man and a good dude.
Yeah, so you're always sort of like the kind of art nerd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Way.
In high school and everything else?
All the time, yeah.
And what did you do? Where did you? What was your in high school? Did you play in bands ever?
No, I don't have primary talent. I'm not the kind of person that could pick up an instrument or play it or pick up a brush and paint.
Yeah.
I have always just like appreciated and tried to connect people and just wanted to be around folks who were that kind of creative, hoping that something would rub off.
Well, what did you do well, Dan?
I was really good at schmoozing.
No, but I mean, back in the day, what did you go to college for?
I went to college for, I started in electrical engineering and realized I wasn't smart enough and wound up in a physics degree program.
Uh-huh.
Got my degree.
You got a physics degree?
Physics with a minor in math.
So you can wrap your head around that stuff?
No. Towards the end, it was beyond me.
If I
couldn't picture it physically anymore,
yeah,
it kind of lost any connection to anything for me.
So you weren't good at math or physics, really?
Good enough at math.
Yeah.
You know, if you put your mind to it, you can get through just about anything, but you also know what your limits are.
But you were no wizard.
I was not a wizard. Oh my God. I went to school with wizards.
So where does music come in?
Music came in, you know, when you're isolated and you don't have much, you cling on to weird bits of culture.
Yeah, sure.
So,
what, you mean in Nebraska?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like that's sort of been my modus operandi. And when I moved to, Lincoln to go to college, I started running into other quote-unquote freaks, you know?
I know that town. I performed in that town.
It's a great town.
It's a little beat up, but yeah, it's a good town.
It's hard to go back.
But I mean, yeah, there were freaks there when I went there. It seems like there was a good contingency, a nice, healthy, kind of drunken art contingent there.
Yeah, and at the time that I was there, I knew all of them.
Yeah.
I still know a great deal of them.
All right, so you're in Lincoln, and you're locking in with the weirdos.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts?
Yeah, literally, I was at the university, I picked up a school newspaper, and there was an article about a local rap band. And to me, that blew my mind. I didn't realize bands could be from places other than New York or Nashville
right.
or here or London.
Right.
I just had no concept
yeah.
of that.
Yeah.
So I went and bought that tape, and I thought, wow, they're talking about things that are happening here, the homeless on this street or this place
oh, yeah.
or that.
Yeah.
And it really kind of affected me.
Yeah.
And then I fell in with other people who actually knew local bands.
Right.
Some of them lived on my dorm floor. Some of them were people I just ran into once I started going to shows.
Uh-huh.
And that changed everything for me.
Yeah, in what way? What did you see?
Instead of becoming just a music fan and just loving the Beatles or just loving the Clash or whatever.
Yeah.
I could love Bob and Joe playing in the trio down the street.
Right.
And they were talking about things that were relevant to me because they were my same age and my same exact place.
Yeah.
It just really hit home for me hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And it fell in, there was this group called 13 Nightmares that were, not nationally recognized at all, but they were just so wonderful.
Yeah.
Hard on their sleeve about race relations and like how we did things wrong and yet also rocking and talking about the bullshit.
Were they black?
No.
Oh.
All white folks.
Yeah.
And three of them moved on to become a band called Mercy Rule that got a little bit more notoriety, but not on national levels.
Right. So when did you start getting involved with production? Where was it... You know, did you do any managing or any, you know?
I started going to shows so much that I started becoming part of the scene.
Right.
And then there was one band that I actually would help them load in and load out.
Right.
And it wasn't really management.
What band was that?
It was a band called Such Sweet Thunder.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
They were from Kearney, Nebraska, but one of the dudes lived in Lincoln.
Punk rock?
No, it was like REM runs into the Replacements.
Oh, okay.
So. Really jangly, like these innocent, heartfelt songs. They eventually got heavier as time went on.
Yeah.
But the first stuff is so like naive and innocent and pure and heartfelt that it just sucks you in.
Yeah.
But it did me at least. Yeah. You might go, whatever. But
I remember liking a few songs by that album you gave me, that Chuglin album.
Oh, Chuglin was a great Minneapolis band. Yeah, I still go crazy for them.
So, all right, so you're loading in and out, you're following bands around, everyone knows you on the scene.
And then I started
there's
working.
There's the tall Jew.
There's the tall Jew.
They would say lovingly.
Yeah, well, and to hear it lovingly and without derision was something nice for a change.
Good.
So I started working at the University Program Council and booking bands to play at the university. Small bands, not the big national touring stuff.
Right, right.
And that got me in with them a little bit more. Then I got hired to manage a record store by a friend from an Omaha record store.
In Lincoln?
In Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And
like
all
used records, classic?
Used indie stuff and a lot of live imports.
So, oh, right, right, right. The bootlegs.
Yes.
So you were the record store guy.
I was a record store manager, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you were in charge of buying?
I actually dealt with Sub Pop regularly, and I dealt with Dutch East India, which was a big distributor.
So this is where you got educated as mm-hmm. to what was out there.
And at the same time, physics was becoming incomprehensible.
Yeah.
So it became very clear to me where I wanted to put my energy.
Oh, good. Because of the management job at the record store.
The management job at the record store, booking bands at the university, yeah. knowing all the bands.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, it strikes me, Sub Pop is just now taking off with Nirvana.
Right.
Taking off.
So this is 91, yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I know bands and I know distributors and I buy from them. They'll buy from me if I tell them I have something.
Uh-huh.
I can do this.
Right, yeah.
So I quickly figured out it, to talk to Such Sweet Thunder. They had already had two albums that they wanted to put together as a CD maybe.
Uh-huh.
I borrowed $1,000 from my brother and from the guy that owned the main local bar that all the bands played
back
at.
Back when you and your brother were talking?
Yeah, back yeah. when we were still like brothers.
Yeah. yeah.
You know, now we're not we're yeah. even acquaintances.
Right.
But yeah, back then, I put up $1,000 of my own, and we did the CD. It came out November 6th of 1992.
Yeah.
And within 6 months, I had everyone paid off with interest.
You sold it? How'd you sell it?
At shows and at the store I worked at.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you made the money back?
And the distributor picked it up, too.
Yeah, and did they get any traction, really?
They didn't get huge traction, but I mean, back then, you make 1,000 copies. If you sold 1,000 copies,
yeah,
you were
great.
You didn't make more. You were like, hey, we're done. It's yeah. great.
yeah, right, yeah. So you had a success.
Wild success, by my opinion.
Right.
So then I fooled myself into thinking I could do it.
You're a mogul.
From there on out, it was just Daffy Duck explosion after Daffy Duck explosion.
Really?
Yeah.
So right after the first one, it just went south?
It took, we had probably, over the course of 6 years, we probably had like seven records that did well.
So you were a label?
It was a label. It wound up becoming more of a co-op.
What was the name of the label?
It started as ISM.
Yeah.
ISM, which stood for In Spite of Myself.
Yeah.
Which was the reason I woke up.
Right.
And then there was a band in New Jersey called ISM, and they said, you can't use that name. So yeah. I switched it to the more confusing ISMist,
yeah.
which stood for In Spite of Myself, In Spite of Them.
Yeah.
And that's what I stayed at until comedy came up for me.
So you did seven records, you said?
No, we did 70, but maybe seven of them were
seven. ISMist did 70 records?
Yeah, in 6 years.
And seven of them what?
Were successful.
Which ones?
Such Sweet Thunder, the Honey Boy Turner Band. I helped distribute the first Slipknot CD.
But you didn't record it?
I did not record it.
Uh-huh.
But I'm one of like five, six people that helped.
Got it out there?
Push them.
Were you still at the record store or was this after?
This was after.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, okay, so that's four?
Those are four. And then I did a single for Killdozer from Madison, Wisconsin. That's five.
They're big.
Yeah, they were decent.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were good dudes.
Yeah.
I have to think, there was a compilation called Lenomo, which was Lincoln Omaha bands that did really well. And I can't remember the other one right off the top.
But you did 70.
We did 70 records total. But a lot of it was like co-op where the band said, could we use your name and you distribute it? And
right.
We'll put the money in.
So you built these distributing relationships just from, you know, from the record store initially and then just building out with some of the more successful.
Correct.
And you dealt with mostly what, record stores?
I dealt with record stores and the distributor, and then eventually there was a distributor in Kansas City that got us into the Best Buy system.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So those were just working connections.
Yep.
Back when you had hard copies of things.
Exactly.
Before MP3s.
Yeah, yeah, before Napster.
Oh, Napster fucked it.
Wait, oh, God, did it.
When the fuck was that, 92, 90?
Napster was 98. 99.
Was that the beginning of it when everyone was just ripping everything?
Yep.
98, 99.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because it was right about the time I was moving to Minnesota.
All right. So, yeah, how does that all work? So you put out 70 records. When do you move to Minnesota?
I moved to Minnesota in November of 98.
So this is after the 70 records or you're still doing music at that time?
No. This is probably at about 67 records. I think okay. I did like three once I moved to Minnesota.
So Napster hits and you realize that you're in trouble?
Napster hit I didn't know I was in trouble yet. Comedy started for me before Napster hit.
So what was it? But people are still buying CDs, right? There's no really...
People were buying CDs all the way. I mean, people still buy CDs. The whole thing of
them
not... I get
a check from you every few months.
Yeah, my weird little checks.
Yeah. But that's from CD sales. Oh, no, that's from digital as well.
That's right. CDs were selling pretty well all the way up until about, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And they still sell well if the artist pushes them, but they don't sell well via retail.
Right.
Yeah.
So why do you start doing comedy? What's the white light moment that you have?
I was always a fan of comedy. I was brought up with it from real young.
Yeah, like what?
They're Israeli sketch comedy.
Really?
Yeah. My mom.
Do you speak Hebrew?
I do. Yeah. Not very well. I make a lot of mistakes in gender and tense, but I speak pretty well.
Yiddish?
No, I don't even really understand Yiddish.
Right. That's a Polish Hebrew.
Polish
thing.
German. Yeah.
Russian. Yeah. A little bit of everything. That was the idea. It's a regional thing.
Yeah, but it's mainly based on Old German is the main basis. Yeah.
Okay. So, all right. So, you comedy, Israeli sketch comedy?
Yeah, they were basically the Monty Python of Israel without aping Monty Python.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with malapropisms and turns of phrase that are still important in Hebrew in Israel right now. Like, they really helped change and shape the language as it was developing.
Interesting.
So, like, my mom had those records, and there were certain... I'm not going to start telling you the names of the things.
What's the name of the group?
They're called Hagashash, uh-huh. Hachaver.
Hagashash, Hachaver.
Yeah, Hachaver. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Hachaver.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, the Pale Tracker is what that translates to.
The Pale Tracker?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
That's just the name of it.
Okay.
Like Monty Python, what's
How
that
many mean? Records they have out?
Oh, man, probably about... 8 or 12 at this point. I mean, a couple members have died now, but they're...
Like when you were a kid, there were only a few?
There were like 7, 8 of them.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And this made you laugh. You loved it.
Oh, yeah. There's certain bits that still make me laugh.
And they're all in Hebrew.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
They played Carnegie Hall once, I heard, but I don't know if it was in English or in Hebrew.
And so this was... Did you have other comedy records?
How it started for me. Then it was TV.
Uh-huh.
You know, the big HBO push.
Sure.
Then kind of Comedy Central, but also, like, you know, the big push of HBO was also the time of Kinison and Dice and Roseanne and...
Late 80s?
Yeah, early 80s.
Really?
That's yeah, right. Yeah, oh, yeah, that's Louis, right. Yeah. Louis Anderson.
Sure.
And,
the original push.
Yeah, the push. So that's kind of what was the big influence.
Kurt Kinison was sort of late 80s, but Louis, I think, and Roseanne...
were early 80s. Schimmel was in that mix, too.
So you're listening to all that stuff, and what makes you decide that it's a viable, you know, because like the weird thing about stand-up records and about you in particular is that, you know, in terms of my peer group, you know, and people younger than me, I mean, you recorded most of us.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of us, you know, and we can go over names later, but like what started to make you think you could do it or how did that, what was the first record?
Honestly, I think I knew I could do it.
Well, right, because you'd done records before.
Yeah, because the music thing was such proof to me. And when I lived in Lincoln, I remember there was an episode of Tompkins Square.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, I want to say it was...
Oh, Jeff Ross? Who directed, like, that was the worst show. I think I remember doing it, but like, yeah, it was out in the park.
It was in the park. But I can't remember who was the host, honestly, but I remember that it was an episode with Judy Gold, Dana Gould, Greg Proops, and Lewis Black.
Right.
And Lewis Black became like a Ron Livingston character.
I remember the taping of this. I mean, I taped that day, same night.
Oh, really?
I remember, yeah.
Wow.
I think so. I mean, I did it because I remember being down there. Outdoors.
And they would have done multiple episodes in a night? Because it was an hour-long show from what I remember.
Really? Maybe they did mix and match even. I don't know. Like, I feel like I was down there.
Right. But to me, I was sitting in this apartment in Lincoln, and Lewis came on. And he was kind of like a Ron Livingston sort of guy, the guy from Office Space.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you don't know his name, but it's like, that guy.
Yeah. He was on The Daily Show.
He was on The Daily Show, but I hadn't put that together yet.
Yeah, yeah.
The original Daily Show.
Before Jon Stewart.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was on from Kilborn.
Yeah.
But I saw that episode of Tompkins Square, and I was like, that guy is great. Too bad I'll never meet him living here.
Yeah.
I'd love to do something with him.
Yeah.
And then I put it together that he was on The Daily Show. And, you know, my wife and I would talk about him the way we talked about Ron Livingston. That guy turned up again.
Yeah.
I moved
He'd been around for a while at that point.
But I didn't know that.
But he'd been doing other things. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So I moved to Minneapolis, And then 3 months after I move, I'm working a gig and driving back and forth, and I hear an ad on this radio station saying that he's going to be in Minneapolis at a comedy club.
Yeah.
Now, I've been to theaters to see comedy, but I'd never been to a comedy club.
Yeah. He was at Acme?
He was at Acme.
Yeah.
I ran home, called, got the address, figured out how to get there because I was new to town and I lived ways away from it. Went straight to the club with a handful of CDs from my music label and a note that I wrote out in my car.
Yeah.
Handed it to the usher, and I expected it to be like a rock venue where Elvis has left the building. You don't get to meet the act.
No, he's sitting in the room and back.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So I hand the stuff to an usher, watch the show, have a great night.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I guess that's it. I hope this message in a bottle gets to him. And you know Acme, it's like a fish tank. There's two big glass walls.
Yeah.
I'm leaving, and I see him standing in the middle of the bar.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is my goddamn chance.
Yeah.
So I walked up and I introduced myself and I asked if he got the stuff I had left, and he hadn't. So I pitched him right there. Just as an eager, here's my shot. This is it. And he—
What did you say? I'm going to make a record with you.
I want to make a record with you. I've made records with bands for a number of years now. And there was, you know, I see you in the tradition of this guy and that guy and that guy. And I just really think that there should be some kind of record of it other than what's on TV.
Yeah.
And, I must not have come across as a crazed lunatic because he seemed interested.
Yeah.
And he told me how Warner Brothers had just said no and that he was actually open to doing something. And this is before Comedy Central had a record label.
Right.
So he basically said, get a hold of my management. Go. I run out to a payphone, call my wife, who's still in Nebraska at the time, getting ready for the wedding. And I tell her what happened, and we're like both jumping up and down for joy, and nothing's happened yet.
Yeah.
It took months, then we finally recorded.
Yeah.
And he was super great about it.
Where'd you record?
Madison, Wisconsin, at a club called Laugh Lines. It's no longer there.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then, like, 2 years later, you finished mixing it.
God damn it, Mark.
I'm sorry.
I am never going to... There's just no way I'm going to ever live it.
It's all right. I'm sorry.
I will serve no wine before it's time, Mark.
I know. I've grown to appreciate the process. But okay, so you laid down the tracks.
We laid down the tracks, and it was my first album. I was working with a recording engineer in Madison who I knew was very high quality. And I worked in Minneapolis, so it would be a four-hour drive to get to his house to work on, or his studio to get to work on stuff.
Yeah.
So everything was very meticulously done and planned, and we listened to all the shows. It was like, for him, I think we had five shows. It might have been six.
Uh-huh.
And we charted out where every joke was, and we tried to analyze what the flows of the jokes were from this one to that one to try and make an actual workable pattern.
Yeah.
And then also to try and include as much of the material as we could before we started winnowing stuff out.
Right.
And that was what was so time consuming.
Yeah.
Because...
Which show, and then the mix down if you're pulling things from different shows.
Well, the mix down, you do everything first. Uh-huh. You do all of it first as if you're going to use all of it.
You level it all out?
You level it all out so that when you decide to cut, there's no time lost in it. You just cut.
Right.
So that's how I do it, at least.
Do you change the order ever?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have to. You have to. Because sometimes there's things that tie together, jokes that should have been grouped together that weren't, or things that have callbacks that are too far apart or not near, you know, or too near.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so you have to be able to do that stuff.
So, all right, so what was the first record called?
The White Album.
Oh, it was the White, so that was big.
That's number one for me. As stand-up
you still
records,
make your money.
Yeah, it's still selling.
Yeah.
Still downloaded, still. Look, it's, how do you talk about this stuff without sounding like you're breaking your arm patting yourself? It's a legendary record.
Yeah.
I got lucky. I got real lucky to put myself in that place.
And
to
that
make
was your
happen.
First record.
Number one comedy record.
And
it sold wildly.
Yeah.
This is as Napster's going.
Yeah.
So we were still selling records then because Napster hadn't destroyed.
Did you record
them
on vinyl at that time or no?
The vinyl came shortly. Okay, so his record initially came out on my old label, Islamist. Yeah. I called him once on his cell phone and pitched to him doing vinyl of it. And he was on a plane that was about to close the door. He goes, why do vinyl? I go, we've sold 10,000 copies of this record so far. We can do a run of 500 LPs, and that's literally 0.5% of what we've actually sold. I think we'll be fine to sell 500 copies on vinyl. He goes, if you think you can do it, do it. So I issued the vinyl, still on my old label.
Yeah.
And it sold fast. We made a, he came to Minneapolis once and my wife baked a cheesecake and I brought him to the house and he saw, signed all of the covers.
She baked a cheesecake?
Yeah.
She's Jewish?
She converted.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was cheesecake learning how to make a cheesecake part of it?
No, it was that was out of sheer joy, I think.
I don't know. I mean, it's probably not even a Jewish thing, cheesecake.
Well, it's a New York thing, juniors,
yeah.
Man.
Sure, I know, yeah. Juniors, yeah. I actually have grown to prefer ricotta cheesecake, Italian style. Cheesecake.
Yeah, my mom loves ricotta style, and that's what she makes.
Love it. All right, so you have a big hit record, basically, for a comedy
record. For a comedy record, yeah. And this is before Billboard had a comedy chart, so there was really no way to document it at the time.
And, well, if it really was huge, it would make the regular charts.
Yeah, but I think we sold over the course of time 60,000 copies.
That's
it
great.
Might be more now. I don't remember exactly.
How many records did you do with Lewis?
I did 2 records and an EP on my label, and then I produced 4 more for Comedy Central.
Oh, so he brought you along.
Yeah.
That's good of him.
It was great of him.
Did you get points on those?
I got no points. I didn't even get a fee.
What?
Yeah.
That's not a good deal, Dan.
No, I look, I know now.
What do you mean you know now? We want you to do this, we're not going to pay you? There wasn't a red flag?
I got vinyl rights on the first 2.
Okay.
And then the 3rd one got me a Grammy.
Yeah.
How am I going to come? Oh, yeah, you didn't pay me.
Yeah.
I got a Grammy Award. I'm set for life now.
Are you?
Not financially, but I can always get work.
Oh, right. Right.
Who doesn't want to hire a Grammy Award-winning producer?
Right. And has that panned out?
It's done okay. I'm not wealthy. I don't live in a...
No, I know. But like, do you have to use that as a calling card ever?
It never hurts to have it.
How many records have you released on stand-up?
It is at 196 right now. And that's records, videos, LPs, cassettes, all that stuff.
But 196
releases.
Separate releases.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying before, like, you know, I was number 21, you said, or 20?
You were number 21.
Yeah.
Tickets is number 21.
Tickets still available. But like you, like I was saying, you've done like everybody's at least their first 2 records, right?
A lot of them, yeah. A lot
Maria Bamford, like we talked about Lewis, you got Hannibal Buress. Brendan Burns, wow. I'm not going to mention everybody. David Cross, Chad Daniels, Jim David, DeStefano, you did. Fuck, dude. Like, who else here? Judy Gold, Eddie Gosling, Dana Gould. I'm obviously doing people I know. Renee Hicks, Jackie Cation, Jonathan Katz, wow. Kinane.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of those are vinyl licenses, you know, where they had the record come out somewhere else and I did the LP.
Oh, version. LaBelle, Danny LaBelle, you
Danny
probably
LaBelle,
record?
Yep, yeah, I did.
You didn't fly to Spain to do that record, did you?
I was supposed to, but then I had my neck surgery, so I had to cancel the trip.
Oh.
I got to go to Scotland for the first album, but I didn't get to go to Spain for the second one.
Oh. Mary Mack, she's great.
Yep.
I haven't talked to her in a while. How about Stanhope?
Stanhope brought his records to... Okay, Stanhope's manager at the time were the same... as Lewis's managers. So they brought him to me, but he wanted the license. So I licensed the first 4 records and the 5th one I didn't own.
Bobby Kelly?
Yeah, that I licensed his first self-released record.
Okay, so what does it mean when you license?
It means the
rights... I'm not even mentioning all the names, by the way.
Right, right. The licenses are generally like the artist already had paid to record it and have it done.
Yeah.
And then they distributed it until they didn't want to deal with it anymore. And then I licensed it to take it over to get it back into
from them.
Yeah.
And that means you own it as a partner or you own it?
No, they own it and I have the rights to manufacture and distribute and pay royalties.
Oh, I get it. Okay. So you could do that with anything?
It depends. You could. I mean, if the artist is willing. Some artists aren't willing.
Uh-huh. But you do a lot of business like that.
A fair amount. I think any label that's smart would.
Yeah. And your label is successful still.
Yeah. I'm not, like I say, I'm not wealthy, but like... my bills are covered and I could come out here and record when I need to and go wherever.
What are you doing out here?
I'm here to see you.
That's it?
And I'm also
I thought
seeing
you were going to be here.
I'm also seeing a ton of old friends.
This
is like a you got to remember I went through a life altering thing.
Yeah.
So
I remember.
It's not just business. Some of it is reconnecting to maintain my spirits and to keep moving forward.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I spent a lot of time that whole staring into the abyss stares back.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of physical and mental energy to get through a day now.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be a psychic vampire, but I am here to reconnect with why I do what I do.
Yeah.
In order to prep for this.
You're going to come down to the Comedy Store tonight?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
I might.
I mean, this
I had no plans for
it. There's probably some people you know. What were you, like, are you seeing comics? A lot of the friends of yours comics?
A lot of my friends are comics, but I'm seeing them outside of comedy shows so that we can actually sit and talk. And
that's nice. How long are you out here for?
Till Monday.
Uh-huh. So you got a kid now, right?
Yeah.
How'd that kid turn out?
She is becoming her own person now. She's 9.
Uh-huh.
Sweet person. Still figuring out boundaries, of course, because you do that your whole life.
Sure.
But she is just... It's fun to watch the world be new.
Yeah. Sure.
And it makes you appreciate some things you didn't necessarily appreciate. And it opens your heart in ways that you didn't expect.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And it's been a great experience. I feel bad for her that she has a crippled father.
Uh-huh.
Because I can't chase her around. I can't do all... When she was a baby, like, I would give her suplexes on our bed, you know?
Right.
Like, we'd set up cushions, and I would just lift her on my shoulder and back and over.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And I can't really do that kind of stuff now. I can't just take her and play soccer with her with a cane. You
right.
Know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're still moving.
Yeah, but it's just not the experience I was hoping to give her, but she's a great kid. She's turning out wonderfully.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. And I just took dates in Minneapolis. I'm going to be up there in September.
Oh, nice.
In September. So, well, what do you got? What are you working on now? Like, what albums are like in the pipeline?
In the pipeline right now is vinyl for David Cross's his most recent tour that it had a Netflix special.
Yeah.
That's also a license, but we were working together to make sure all the vinyl colors are right. And because it's themed about our current president, who I don't want to name by name.
Yeah.
You know, there's different color schemes that include piss yellow and Halloween orange and then the Russian flag.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so that project is just about done and released.
Do records sell well?
There's a lot of hype in vinyl.
No, I know, but the last two albums I did, the last two specials I did, like Netflix released vinyl, and I didn't even really consult on the cover. I just said, just if you need to put it out for, you know, Grammy consideration, put it out. Like, I didn't put any effort into it at all.
So the most recent one came out on vinyl?
Yeah, Too Real came out on vinyl.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Now I'm going to have to hunt for it.
Yeah, I don't know if you can get, I don't know how many they made. I only have a few.
Oh, wow.
But like I didn't do any cover art or nothing. But like the other one, you know what didn't come out on vinyl is More Later, which is a good one.
Oh.
Maybe we can do that. I just like, I as much vinyl as I buy, like, you know, I know for a fact that, you know, I collect old comedy records, but I don't listen to them too often.
Yeah, but I mean, comedy records are a different thing.
What I mean, yeah.
Yeah. To me, you know, vinyl's a multi- edged weapon.
Yeah.
You know, I want my stuff to be on vinyl because I want it to be with the classics.
Yeah.
You know, and
right.
And that's the main reason you do it. But vinyl also practically is $4,000 that sits on a pallet that will almost likely never be $4,000 again.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
there's
it can
a lot
take,
of stuff like that.
Yeah. It takes years and years and years to move the stuff.
It does?
It can, unless you're out there. Like, I'll tell you the one successful, really successful vinyl story I have. When I did that Kyle Kinane license, we were sold out within a year.
How many did you print?
500.
Records.
Records.
Yeah.
LP records.
Yeah.
But I've had other artists where...
Still sitting there?
Yeah. Over 10 years.
Do you have Dave Cross's Shut Up, You Fucking Baby?
I ran out of those. Uh-huh. I ran out of that, and I ran out of It's Not Funny.
Yeah.
But it took a while.
Uh-huh.
And you wouldn't think it would, because you would think his crowd particularly would like vinyl.
Well, I mean, vinyl's still pretty specific, and like I've got some great old comedy records. Like, and sometimes I do put them on. Like, I have a really old Rodney record that was before he sort of was doing the I Get No Respect thing.
Was it The Loser?
Yeah, The Loser.
Yeah, that's a good record.
It's a great record.
Yeah. But No Respect is like the gold standard of any comedy album, I think.
Oh, it's called No Respect?
There's two albums he has that have similar titles. There's an earlier one called I Can't Get No Respect.
From the 70s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's the 80s No Respect, where he has the washcloth to
sure,
his head.
Yeah.
And that record is the gold standard of comedy on vinyl, in my opinion.
Really?
Yeah.
But because it's not worth a lot of money.
It's not worth a lot of money, but it does. I mean, I'm not talking value. I'm talking.
I got to get one then.
Oh, my God.
I don't think I have that one. I got
to
go look.
Front to back, solid.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Huh. I got some weird old ones in there. Well, you probably have a bunch.
I have hundreds.
Yeah. I got a couple hundred.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Just comedy?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think so. Yeah. You know, I just kind of pick him up. Got a lot of the Red Fox Party records.
Nice. He had so many, though.
Yeah,
it's hard
so
to
so many.
Yeah.
But I got a few of those. I have a later Red Fox record.
You Gotta Wash Your Ass.
You Gotta Wash Your Ass.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
a classic.
Yeah, yeah. It's not classic to listen to, per se, but it's certainly a great cover.
Oddly enough, hardly any of his albums are classics to listen to because time has not been kind, because now you can say all the words he couldn't say then.
Yeah, all right. Well, we can go look at some comedy records. I'm glad you're okay.
Thanks, man.
And that you came through the harrowing. Did you go to the Mayo Clinic or wherever?
No. I was in three different hospitals for 5 stays total with only ambulance rides in between them for the course of a month.
Doesn't the Mayo have a presence in Minneapolis? Or
they do, but it's mainly in Rochester, an hour and a half away, but that's more cancer than like degenerative bone disease.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it looks like they put you together all right.
You know what? All the king's horses and all the king's men.
They pulled it together.
There were so many people involved in putting me back on my feet.
Uh huh.
And it's really more of a credit to them than to me, because I'm kind of I can be a quitter.
Yeah.
And they put so much work into me that I have to succeed for them.
How was being dead for 3 minutes?
It was the most terrifying thing I've been through.
Really? You remember it?
I don't remember what the reality of it was. I remember what I saw.
Yeah.
And it was groovy in a way, because it was like a little bit of 2001, a little bit Star Trek, but it was like the Red Alert parts of Star Trek.
Right.
Like I was in front of a control panel that I couldn't read, and everything was shaking and falling apart, and I knew I was screwed. I was very aware that I was screwed the whole time. I was out.
Really?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem like an exciting thing to look forward to.
It was terrifying. That's what I told you. It was the most terrifying.
I know that. I'm just saying that generally, like, you didn't see any lights that you were
the lights
moving.
That I saw were like the 2001 tunnel effect.
Yeah, the rainbow tunnel.
And that was cool.
Yeah.
But it was also in the context of literally everything is shaking apart, and I knew I was panicking. I mean, you got to remember, I remember seeing my wife and trying to tell her to help me.
And then you went out?
And I was looking at her and looking at the door and looking at her and looking at the door and looking at her and looking at the door to try and signal, get out of here.
Yeah.
And I was also trying to, like, I know telecommunication doesn't work, but if you can read my mind, get up and go get someone.
Yeah.
Those are my last conscious thoughts. Ugh.
So that's how you entered it.
And that's how I entered it.
Yeah.
So I already knew I was screwed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I knew I couldn't breathe. I knew I couldn't push air.
Yeah.
The next thing I saw after the crazy out of body, you know, that stuff was my nurse's face appeared like Garrett Morris in the corner.
Uh-huh.
Literally, like a bubble appeared out of the black, and it was just big enough for her face.
Uh-huh.
And I could see, and she's like, I have your hand. I'm here with you. Stay with me. Talk to me. And I could see when I looked at her that I had an oxygen mask on.
Yeah.
But if I turned my head, it was back into the rainbow tunnel. Everything's falling apart. Red alerts, lights.
Huh.
Yeah. And it took a while. After a while, I realized there were more people in the room and I couldn't see them.
Yeah.
I could only hear them through that bubble that I saw her in.
Yeah.
And that bubble would occasionally get like watery, like, you know, someone's pouring water over glass and you're looking through it.
Yeah.
So it was fading in and out.
Oof.
And anytime she turned away, I would scream her name so that she would turn back.
And you could push air at that point?
Because at that point, they took me from the chair and had me laying down, and my head was back, and the passageway was open.
Oh, man. Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I knew they were cleaning me up from having died and lost muscle control.
Yeah.
I couldn't feel them doing it. I could hear them talking about it.
Yeah.
And I tried to make a joke out of it, and the joke didn't translate. And I remember my first feeling of that, telling a joke and not having it go over, was just, I could feel my shoulders slump like, oh, they didn't get it.
And they're cleaning up my shit.
Well, I only knew that from context, not from actual physical.
Oh, there you go. So like now you have a nice comedic story.
It was the worst.
You just tanked.
Yeah, yeah. It was
one joke.
It was like
one shot.
Yeah, I said, you'll have to excuse me. My wife shit my pants.
Uh huh.
And the nurse turns and says, I don't know what he's talking about. And I just went, ugh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an easy joke to misunderstand.
Yeah, yeah, especially if we say
given the situation.
A non sequitur, yeah.
A non sequitur, and they've just pulled you out of the tunnel.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I literally was basically holding on long enough for them to open the tunnel wide enough to grab me.
Well, I'm glad you made it.
Well, thanks, man.
And thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me. It's so good to see you again.
It's good to see you, too. And also, like, I'm sorry if I yelled at you too much.
You know, it's years ago now.
We both grew up. But like, I know it can be difficult. And at that time, I was yelling a lot. And I imagine it was only about how long is this going to fucking take.
But the thing that I appreciate now is that you told me that you understand the process more now.
I do.
No one who's going through the process, even to this day, no one who is going through the process gets that this isn't just snap your fingers and it's done.
Sure, but I'm going to continue making jokes to people that tell me they're going to do a record with you.
But please, you know, realize you're also affecting my livelihood.
No, I'm not. Usually it's people who are already in it.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm not telling people not to do a record with you. Like, if they tell me, like, I just recorded with Dan Twistle, I'll say something like, someone came up to me and said, I just did a record with Dan Twistle, we just got done recording, I'm like, oh, it'll be released in 2020, it's going to be great, that kind of thing. See, look, well, yeah, but like, you laugh for a minute, but part of you was like, that's about right?
6 months to a year, depends. There's been times where I've turned them in 3 to 4 months, but those are exceptions.
No, it's because you want it to be right, and they all came out. The two that I did with you specifically were great. And, it was a lot of stuff to go through for both of them. And I do understand your process.
Well, and not only that, you were going through a lot of stuff and change at that time, too.
It was a fucking disaster.
It was. But, man, what beautiful art did you turn out of it?
Train wreck, man. I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you I'm glad you were so supportive.
Well, yeah, I'm always there for that.
Thanks. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too.
Okay. Dan Schlissel, Stand Up Records at standuprecords.com. Go check out the catalog. Buy some titles. Get caught up. Comedy records are fun. I collect them. There's not that many I listen to over and over again, but there's a few. There's a few I listen to a lot of times. Funny, it's weird who I end up like. You know who I listen to a lot, but they're not on Stand Up Records, but Tom Sharpling and John Worcester. That box set is great. But I end up listening to Robert Schimmel if he comes on. I get a big kick out of his pace, R.I.P., Robert Schimmel. And I listen, there's a few records I listen to. I feel like listening to one now. What comedy record would I listen to right now? I would probably go in and listen to the Rodney Dangerfield album before he really became Rodney Dangerfield, before he got the hook, the No Respect hook, and he was sort of doing long form type of stuff. The Loser record. So, all right, so that's, well, I'm back. I'm going to be in Minneapolis this week. I believe all those shows are sold out. I'm going to be in Denver on the 21st, is it? The Comedy Works, September 21st and 22nd. I think there's some tickets left. A few tickets left for Stand Up Live, October 13th. That's in Phoenix. And the Beacon Theater, of course, November 10th, I believe. You can go to nycomedyfestival.com to get tickets for that. And that's that. I don't have any prepared guitar, but shit, it hasn't stopped me before.
Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.